Hello, my juicy, juicy loves. I'm so happy to be on the call with y'all today. And as you know, the topic that I had promised y'all was the new happy. What happiness means right now to so many of us in this forward-thinking community that we all share. And when I realized that today's call coincided with the paperback release of I Believe, which is by my brilliant friend and mentor, Eldon Taylor, I knew I had to get him on this call for y'all. Eldon is the host of the popular radio show Provocative Enlightenment. He's an award-winning New York Times best-selling author of over 300 books, audio, and video programs. He's the inventor of the patented InnerTalk technology that he so graciously wove into my Juicy Feel meditations that I know y'all are listening to regularly. He's founder and president of Progressive Awareness Research. He's been featured as an expert in film, print, television, and radio. He's been called a master of the mind. I call him that. And he's appeared as an expert witness on hypnosis and subliminal communication, a practicing criminalist who conducted investigations and lie detection examinations, and just a regular amazing guy, fellow of the American Psychotherapy Association, internationally sought-after speaker. Welcome, dude.
Hey, thank you. It's good to join you and your Juicy Joey group. I love what you do. You know that, Lisa. I love it, love it, love it.
You are so sweet. I know. You have always been so kind to me. I want to dish about this stuff because
I'm not being kind to you. I am being honest. You really have a special energy. You really just bubble and effervesce. Being around you just is contagious with excitement and enthusiasm. No, I would park you right next to my desk if I could every day.
I love it. I love it. You are so sweet. Okay. So happiness, right? That's what we're talking about. Everybody wants it, but you've got this thing down to a science, for real. It's really like something that you can just work out scientifically, and it's all about what we believe. That's it, right? There's so
that
much
is
more
so,
to it.
So very, very true. And you know, the interesting thing, after nearly 30 years of research now, I can tell you that there is no such thing as an inconsequential belief. Every single belief we have is knitted together in what turns out to be a very elaborate web, like a giant spider web. And interestingly, if you tweak any one aspect of that web, the entire web vibrates. A lot of people miss that. They think they separate their beliefs. They put them into compartments. You know, I have a belief about, or I have beliefs about success. I have beliefs about relationships. I have beliefs about spirituality, and so on and so forth. When indeed there's no such compartmentalization that goes on. You know, happiness can be described as different things for different people. For some, happiness is like success. I want a solid relationship. Oh, I want success in my job. You know, happiness would just be making more money and getting that position I wanted. Or, you know, happiness is defined as a sense of peace, comfort, and joy. But when you begin to break that down and you say, okay, well, what would produce peace? What would produce happiness? There are a whole lot of empty answers out there. I know your answers aren't empty. But they're
empty. Subjective. Happiness to one person isn't going to be happiness to somebody else, right? And that also depends on your beliefs too, what you define as happiness.
That is so very, very true. And I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, I believe that if you really want to be happy, you have to convolute a lot of the models. It's that simple. And the data clearly shows that. By that, I mean, instead of looking at what you get out of life, you begin to look at life differently. You know, my favorite chapter out of the Tao Te Ching begins with, there are 30 spokes in the wheel. Now, it goes on to tell us all about a wheel. You know, the spokes, and they're made of wood, and the outer part of the wheel, and maybe it's banded with metal, and maybe it discusses things like pots. And clay pots. And when you describe a clay pot, you naturally think of, well, the glaze and perhaps the color and the clay and maybe the size. But what you don't think about is the space, the emptiness. And you see, a pot has no value if it hasn't got a hollow empty space. Mm-hmm. And a wheel has no value if it hasn't got a hollow, holes, space in the hubs so it could be mounted to a cart and turn on an axle. Well, we tend to define things that way in our lives. We get all caught up with things, material things. That becomes a part of our belief, including how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as a noun. You know, I'm 6 foot tall. My name's Eldon Taylor. I live in Spokane. I graduated from. I have awards in. I like collector cars. I'm in my home. But when the time comes that maybe we transition from this life to the other side, we don't take any of that with us. The only thing we take with us is our experience. Our experience, and that includes our relationships, our experience
that's the
then becomes.
In the pot, right?
Right. That really becomes who we are. You know, we are that experience, that space in the pot. We're not the walls or the roof or the floor in the home. We're the space in the room. And without the space in the room, what good is a home? And that's basically who we are. Well, if we convolute our model, if we look at that as a definition, then instead of thinking about what I'm going to acquire, all these things, you know, my new car, new briefcase, a better job, more money, another relationship, what I want to do is begin to think about the quality of the experience. And that experience is built in my beliefs. I mean, my beliefs can be mind as slayer as well as they can be mind as servant. So
sure.
if I begin to do that, Lisa, if I really begin then to think of myself as that experience, what I do is I go about my life differently. You know, let me share a story with you. I like stories because they stick with people. This was
yeah,
one of my.
Yeah, it's not just positive thinking, right? I mean, positive thinking can have some dangerous ramifications. I found in my own life. So
that's true. You know, false optimism, without a doubt. You know. But we're not just talking about positive thinking. We're talking about true belief. And you know, there's a difference between I want to believe and a true belief. There's a difference between, you know, an affirmation that I'm claiming for myself and what I genuinely believe.
Right.
You know, we maybe can go into that. But the point, the story I wanted to share with the listening audience is, years ago, I had a young lady was sent to me by a consulting psychiatrist, and she had a history of self-mutilation, clinical depression, serious clinical depression, and a couple attempts at suicide. When I looked at her medical intake sheets, the first thing that I noticed was that her first therapist was Milton Erickson. Now, as far as I'm concerned, Milton Erickson walks on water. You know, he's the father of NLP and modern hypnotherapy and so much more. So there, I had this, you know, question. If Erickson couldn't help her, what on earth am I supposed to do? And serendipity, if you will, visited me at that moment. I had this flash, this idea. So I sat down with her and I, you know, I'll give her just a name. I'm not going to use her real name. I'll give her a name. I said, Joni, this is what I want. We're going to do 10 weeks of brief therapy. So I'm going to see you once a week for 10 weeks, but you're going to have homework. And if you're willing to do this, in 10 weeks your life will be different. But the only way I'm going to know that you're willing is if you do your homework. And this is what your homework is. Well, essentially what I had her do, the core of her homework, was that first week she had to do a good deed every single day for anyone. But she had to go out of her way to do a good deed. At the end of the day, she would take a new journal, buy a journal, make a journal, take a new journal, and write in that journal at bedtime what the good deed was that she did, who she did it for, how she thinks they felt as a result, and how it made her feel. When she was through, she was to think about that, close her journal, and go to sleep. That was the last thing she was to do before she fell asleep. She had to do that religiously every night and bring her journal in each week. Well, week two, she had to do two a day. Week three, it was three a day. We actually got her up to where it was supposed to be five a day. She didn't always do five a day, but she was doing at least three every single day. And to begin with, some of them were rather lame, you know. I gave this person a couple of pennies for tax at the 7-Eleven. But as they went along, what she began to do was find herself helping people. More opportunities were given to her. She was helping people that before she might have even held some jealousy or animus for. And by the end of 10 weeks, she was off of most of the pharmacology. And I followed this young woman, and I can tell you her life changed. She became non-clinically depressed. In time, she was off of all medication. What happened was, like a lot of people, with her, she lacked self-esteem. She was unfulfilled. There wasn't anything that could provide her happiness, not additional stimulus provided by anything was going to satisfy her. So, stimuli. So what she had discovered as a result of the good deed was that you fill yourself when you realize your life makes a difference. And you can only realize that your life makes... Say that again.
Her beliefs about herself, you were able to shift her beliefs by directing her action so that she developed new beliefs, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, she began to realize her life made a difference. Her life really mattered. She was helping people. And these people were appreciating it. And that ingredient, that giving into life, that convoluted model, I'm not taking it, I'm giving it, made all the difference in the world to her. I've walked away from that. I've since talked to plumbers and attorneys and truck drivers and authors and politicians and you name it, Fortune 500 people about this model. And it, without exception, when they turn and they look at everything they do as a service, I'm not going to work today as a plumber to fix some pipes to make some money. I'm actually going out there to help someone, to solve their problem, to do the best I can to be of service to them. What happens is their quality of life changes. And not only does their quality of life change, but the quality of the lives they interface with does as well. And then it's not at all uncommon to hear of greater transitions, promotions in their job, new relationships. And what happens is the happiness they've been seeking, which they stopped seeking when they started giving, started sharing, started caring about others, became natural, and maybe like a magnet, it stuck to them.
All because you were able to shift their beliefs. Before you go on, I should have mentioned that if y'all have any questions for Eldon as we're talking tonight, you can either call at the call-in number, which I believe you all had. I can give you that again. Or you can just type in your message to Kim. Kim is there doing all the techie stuff. Hi, Kim. What is the call-in number?
If you're gonna, if you want to raise your hand so that we can see you, it's star two. And if you're on the webcast, you can just type your question right into me. But somebody already has typed in a question about self-sabotaging belief for you, Lisa. It actually says, Lisa, you say in Juicy Joy Training that there's no such thing as a self-sabotaging belief. How does this fit in with what Eldon's saying?
Okay, right. Well, what I teach Eldon and Juicy Joy is that it's not so much that our beliefs are self-sabotaging, like they're these evil beliefs that are out to get us, but they actually have the intention of protecting us, usually. That's, they got there as some kind of a protection to keep us from being wounded by life. And unfortunately, it turns out that these very beliefs themselves that we believe are going to protect us are causing the wounding. And so whenever we release beliefs in Juicy Joy Training, we always thank the belief for their good intention and just acknowledge that it doesn't serve us anymore. And that seems to lessen, you know, the power a little bit, because it's not like we're in this big resistance to our enemy beliefs. There's no part of us that's really out to get us. There are just some misguided parts that we just have to release in order to move forward. So I'm sure that's you know, part of what your philosophy is as well, Eldon, right? When you talk about, you know, that the beliefs are sabotaging people, it's not that we really have these parts of us that are turning against us, right? It's just this misinformation that gets lodged in our systems when we're very young.
Right. I'd equivocate a little bit with the way you use the words, but I don't disagree with the intent of what you're saying. You know, we're not given bad beliefs. What we have, and what I think you're attempting to explain, is a whole set of defense mechanisms and defense strategies. We, for all intent and purposes, are herd animals, and
right.
It's very important to us to be accepted. And part of the nature of the physical wiring, the way we're built, this mechanism, our mind, our subconscious mind, will work very hard to protect us, to defend us. All a part of Freud and psychology suggests that we will defend by creating mechanisms that, for all intent and purposes, once developed, become unconscious. So we become unaware of them, but they'll kick in to protect us in some ways that we don't want protection later in life. Quick example of that. I had a communication with a person. This is so appropriate for you, Lisa, because you're always bubbly and bouncing and smiling. whose wife was convinced he was just stoic, had no sense of humor whatsoever, and their relationship was about to come to an end over this. She was embarrassed by his stoicism. He could hear the funniest of jokes and not even smile. But what it came down to is when he was a very young man, he was with some peers, and there was a story told, and I can't tell that because it's a little too risque, but it really cracked him up. He laughed and laughed and laughed, and everyone in the room, they turned looking at him, and they were laughing at his laughter. They made fun of his laughter.
Oh.
It was so humiliating to him that unconsciously he controlled that. He avoided that rejection, that sense of being rejected, by developing a mechanism that stopped him from expressing that side of himself. And for years he went through life failing to express it. Well, now that's, I think, what I would call a self-sabotaging belief. Not that the intention of the belief is to harm you, but that the mechanisms are built in such a way that these things aren't at all uncommon for us to develop as we go through life. I mean, after all, look, we come into the world and we're for all intent and purposes, innocent, exploring all of it, excited about it. Why, we may even pick things out of our diaper and taste it. We don't know. You're not supposed to do that. And along comes someone and they say, oh, Johnny, you shouldn't do that. That's not a nice thing. And Johnny, you don't want to show anger. Anger is not good. And then Johnny, crying, well, you know, you really shouldn't cry. Men don't cry, Johnny. And Johnny, and on and on. And I'm saying, Johnny, it could be Mary, because we all have this. We're all told these things. And our innocence is pillaged. Little by little, we take who we are, and in the words of Robert Bly, we start stuffing it in a bag. And then this bag that we drag with us, this part of us that we're hiding, sooner or later it becomes a very long bag. And we don't stop long enough to unpack it. One of the reasons I wrote I Believe was not just to show the power of beliefs, ranging from how it can cause your death, your wellness, etc., but how you literally unpack all of this thinking that fails to serve us, and how you really engage the power of your mind. I mean, there's three things that I want to make sure we get covered, if I may, Lisa. The first one is, most people do not realize this, but using functional magnetic resonance imaging, we know today that the nucleus accumbens makes 90% or more of all of your decisions. Now, the nucleus accumbens is in the unconscious area of the brain. So what I'm saying is that your unconscious makes 90% plus of your decisions. Now, it does that based on information that you have accumulated over time. Now, not only does it do that in 90% of the instances, but the technician watching your brain make choices can know before you know as much as 10 seconds what you're going to decide. He will always know in advance of what you're going to decide just simply watching your brain. So he knows, watching your brain, what you're going to do before you know what you're going to do. Now, that should alarm a lot of people who are too lazy to take the time to unpack their beliefs and to listen to that stream of consciousness. But here's the two other real takeaways. I was at a neuroscience CEU a couple of weeks ago, spent the entire day facilitated by a neuroscientist. We went through data after data, study, design, findings, conclusions. And when the day was all said and done, there were two takeaways. The first one was, you absolutely can change. When I went to school, IQ was fixed, brain cells began to die at the age of 30 and didn't replenish themselves, personality became fixed young, 4 maybe to 6 years of age, and on and on and on. Well, all of that is false to fact. Today, the state of science tells us you not only can change all of those things, change your IQ, change your personality, but you can change the gray matter. You can increase the gray matter in your brain. You physically can change your brain. Now, the second takeaway, this is a really big one, and again, this is empirical. This is not fluffy, airy-fairy, wish, want. This is empirical data. You can only change what you believe you can change. So understand, if you're fixed in your mindedness, you know, you already have it worked out. You know how everything works. You've got all the right set of beliefs, you know. Well, then you probably walk on water. Because if you don't, there's still room for you to grow and to learn. And that's critically important to realizing all these potentials that exist within you. But if you do think you've got it all made out and you're not walking on water, well, then you probably have a self-fulfilling prophecy. Some bumper sticker like life sucks and then you die will fulfill.
That is absolutely true. Yes.
Amen.
And the science to back that up is in I Believe, which can be purchased today. Tell them how to get the book, Eldon.
You know, listen, if everybody would go to eldontaylor.com, there are wonderful, delightful luminaries like yourself, Lisa McCourt, who want everyone to know this. They want them to understand how powerful their mind is and how, you know, immense this nature of a web of beliefs and the role that it has over our lives in all walks, in all areas, that you're offering. You have one there too, Lisa, gifts for people that get the book. So if you go to my website, eldontaylor.com, you click on the banner that says, you know, has a picture of the book and it's a book launch. It shows you where you can get the book at Books A Million or Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. When you get your, when you buy the book, which is under $15 and comes with a $27.95 CD, so it's really a bargain right now. But when you get the book, you bring your receipt number back and plug it in, and there's $10,000 worth of gifts and prizes there, hundreds of gifts that they're yours. You can simply download them. Lisa has a wonderful gift there, and over 100 other luminaries that really care. Those gifts are there for you when you get your book, and I don't know how you not go get a book when you have that opportunity.
And tell them about the subliminals, because that's been my just really, not my favorite thing, because I love all of your books, but these subliminal audios that Eldon has created, patented, he's the number one guy as far as I've ever heard of in the world for subliminal technology and having it work for people, and anything that you want to do. I mean, how many of them are there, the Inner Talk CDs?
Well, I suppose we have about 300 titles now, Lisa. Everything
anything you want to change your beliefs about, you can look it up. You'll put it in the little search bar, and you'll have an audio for it. And they're great to listen to. They're just like nature sounds or music, and you don't really hear the subliminals. You can hear them if you really listen. They're just like kind of embedded softly underneath there. I've had my kids listening to them every night since they were little. I listen to them every night. They're just really amazing tools.
You know, and when you say that, Lisa, they still continue to amaze me. I share a real quick story, my most recent amazement. A young man with a serious school phobia, he's approaching the seventh grade, and he's going into middle school. His parents don't know what to do. They've tried just about everything imaginable under the sun. I sit down with him, and I, you know, what goes through your mind? It triggers off this fear, and he tells me, and I say, what kind of thoughts would you like to go through your mind? What would you like your mind to say? And we spent about an hour going through what his mind, it'd be really good if his mind would say. And, you know, and I did add a few things, but he was a bright young man, and he knew what he wanted his mind to say. So then we, you know, did a custom program for him, overcoming school phobia. And his parents took it home. They put it on an auto reverse player. He went to school the next day. He's been going to school ever since. And according to his parents, not one manifestation of a phobia or a fear. And according to the young man himself, well, it's something I grew out of. It's something I had way back then. But that CD runs 24/7 on a very low volume in his bedroom and has ever since he got it.
Wow, that is a great story.
I mean, you know what? I mean, just to me, this was a serious phobia. The fear would get over him so badly he'd lose control of his muscles and just shake all over. It was incredible to see that. But that's how powerful our minds can be. You know, when you really look at the data again, I mean, listen, real quick, like, there are multiple personality disordered patients who, in one personality, eye color is blue, snap your fingers, eye color is brown. One personality, they're hypoglycemic, snap your fingers, next personality, normal blood sugar. One personality, they're blind for all intent and purposes, seriously visually impaired. Snap your fingers, they have 20/20 eyes. What is going on with these people? Well, I'll tell you, the only thing that we know for certain is the belief about who they are changed. I'm not Susie. I'm Susan. Susie, she chases. She's wild. Susan is serious. A change of that nature, just a belief change and physiology changes. We think maybe the mechanisms might be in something like epigenetics, but we don't know. But what we do know is this takes place. And what we do know is the only thing is the belief about who they are changes. Well, when you see belief as having that kind of power, it's no longer about Roger Bannister and breaking a 4-minute mile just because everybody said it couldn't be done. It's really not about just positive thinking, although positive thinking should never be put with a just in front of it, because it is very powerful. But it is totally about how you live, what you appreciate in life, what you're able to manifest in your life, the amount of happiness and joy you will experience, and believe me, you are entitled to bubble over just like Juicy Joey Lisa McCourt does every single day, every moment of your life.
Okay, so, but if all those beliefs are subconscious that you were talking about, okay, then we don't even know what they are, but a lot of them are good, usually, those subconscious beliefs, those things that we pick up in our childhood. What can listeners do to start breaking those beliefs? There's, you know, listening to the subliminals, and like I always tell them, beliefs are habits, right? Are habits easy to break? Hell no. Is it possible to break them? Absolutely. So that's why I always brag about the Juicy Feels, that you have put these subliminals into the Juicy Feels, because I, you know, we use that as extra fodder to tell everybody how the Juicy Feels are going to get them to shift those beliefs. What else can people do to address beliefs that we're not even aware of?
Well, you know, inner talk is a great way because, you know, when you're fleshing out the subliminal, as you call it, we call it inner talk. When you're fleshing out, when you come on something symptomatically, like you find yourself getting angry, somebody cuts you off in 5 o'clock traffic and you realize, you know, what am I getting angry about? Why am I putting my body through this stress for, you know, I mean, what was that all about? So somebody got in front of me, you know. Maybe they had a child in the back seat that was injured and they're trying to get to the hospital. When I realize that I'm getting angry, it's really simple to go get an InnerTalk program to deal with anger. Let's assume you're not going to get an InnerTalk program. Let's assume that you want to do this yourself, okay? Maybe you haven't got any money and by the way, there are a lot of free programs at my website, and I'm sure that Lisa has told you that. Let's assume you're doing this the other way. This is what I suggest. First of all, convolute the model and change your behavior. you know, the best way to change a habit is to begin by changing the behavior. Now, if you're having some difficulty changing the behavior, and here I would think about just change your attitude about what you do. Do the little thing I gave you that Joni did. Start a diary about how you're helping people and begin to help people every single day. Do a good deed. I guarantee that'll change your life in and of itself. And it will flesh out a lot of these memories. But these beliefs, I mean, but listen to your stream of consciousness. Your stream of consciousness is the most accurate mirror on what you truly believe. You know, I show this to people all the time. I think I've discussed it with you before, Lisa. But, you know, I will get people together and I will ask them, how many of you want to make $1 million? Everybody will raise their hand. Say, okay, you want to make $1 million this year. You know that you're going to have to do something differently. We're not talking about winning the lotto. So you're going to have to maybe go at risk. You know, you're going to have to get the mindset of a millionaire as well. So I want you to begin to talk to yourself. Think, you know, this year I'm going to make $1 million. And I want you to say it seriously. You know, say it silently, seriously, meaningfully to yourself. And it doesn't take very long before the self-talk begins to come back. Sure, what are you going to do, rob a bank? You know, I've heard this crap before. What is this nonsense? And all this self-defeating dialogue that comes back that mitigates that power. Well, when you get that dialogue back, it's time for you to recognize that, hey, this is not self-supporting. I've got a belief behind this that for some reason causes me to feel that I can't do it. I don't deserve it. I'm inferior. I'm incapable. What is the belief I have? And begin to flesh that belief out. And the best way to do that sometimes is to sit down and do something I call, that is called automatic writing. Just set yourself apart. First person me, second person me. First person me writes on the paper, you know. Okay, what is this negative self-talk about my success about? And then you wait for a second person me to give an answer. And believe me, you will get it. You just think, okay, second person, what is it? Well, you know, who do you know that has ever made $1 million? Isn't that a pipe dream? Well, does it have to be a pipe? And you begin to dialogue. This is often what happens with a bad habit. King tells this story, a professor that facilitated a habits course that I once attended. He said, you know, I wanted to lose weight. He was grossly overweight, a couple of 100 pounds. And he said, so I decided, you know, I know all about habits. I know what I need to do. I am going to lose weight. I'm going to do that by, I'm going to begin by giving up Krispy Kreme. Well, he ate a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts every single day. So I think of this as the Krispy Kreme story. Now, he just moved to a new city. And there wasn't a Krispy Kreme in the city. He had to get on the freeway, go down the road about 5 miles before he would get to a Krispy Kreme, so he would just not get on the road. And this worked out pretty good for him for a couple of months, and he's losing the weight. And then one day he has to go out of town. He's up on the freeway. Ah, Krispy Kreme comes to his mind. And he thinks, well, I could stop at Krispy Kreme, get a donut. And the dialogue in his mind goes, no, you know better than that. You decided no more Krispy Kreme. Well, yeah, but I would just have one donut. No, you never have just one donut. You'll smell those donuts and you know what happened. Well, you know, listen, I was going to stop and get a cup of coffee anyway. I'll just get a cup of coffee there. Come on, who are you kidding? Get a cup of coffee there. You know you're going to get a donut. No, you know, listen, one donut isn't going to hurt me. After all, I haven't had any in a couple of months. And this dialogue continued until he discovered he had exited the freeway and was parking in the Krispy Kreme parking lot. Now, I think a lot of people can relate to that. They can come to understand, you know, listen, I was going to give up the chocolate, but somehow it just got into my mouth. You know, you have these dialogues. Well, when you begin to see this pattern, well, then, again, you have to stop and you have to examine the belief that's giving rise to the argument. And you have to find out the source of that belief. Maybe it is a defense strategy. Maybe the problem, say, here with our story of King is that he began to use food to assuage anxiety. He was using it for the wrong purpose. It became an oral palpative. And it isn't just a habit. There's an underlying strategy that was designed to give rise to making him feel okay about himself, fulfilling him with food. Do you understand what I'm saying, Lisa?
Absolutely. All those unconscious choices that you were talking about, that most of our choices are made unconsciously.
Yes, absolutely.
And to me, it's like closing the gestalt, which we do at, you know, a lot in Juicy Joy Training, where you're really just seeing little bits and pieces of what's motivating you or what's driving you, and you're just sort of filling in that leap with old programming. It's never a new decision. There's never a new thought, really.
That's right. And one of the things, you know, when you say that, Lisa, people don't seem to realize that. Let's take this MRI technology. It's not just used for, you know, health and wellness diagnostic materials and or used by neuro researchers watching the brain do lifetime decisions. It's used by neuromarketers to determine why you do what you do, what stimulates you, how to motivate you, what works. And so, for example, showing a smoker the Surgeon General's warning on a pack of cigarettes apparently engages a thanatos drive, because what happens is a reward center in the brain is excited, and that means the smoker wants to smoke more. So the message from the neuromarketer to the tobacco company is make the message larger and print it on both sides of the pack. Okay, now, when research of this kind is telling these marketers, the people that would sell you a plank in a political platform, a soundbite, sell you a product, when they're telling them how you're plumbed, what motivates your beliefs, how to reach into your subconscious, and you haven't taken the time to self-evaluate or self-examine these mechanisms yourself, well, then you're likely to become a product of their thoughts. And what happens then one day is, well, you change your clothes, and like a chameleon, you change your behavior, you change your dialogue. Well, that's because you're expected to behave differently in a three-piece suit than you are in your cowboy boots and Levi's out back at the barn, you see? Well, and I'll conform to how I'm expected to behave. And so people become chameleons in that sense. Well, chameleon, that's just another word for self-alienated, distance from who you really are. You're just pretending. You're in these pretend roles. And so my favorite question at this point, Lisa, what was your last truly original thought? And I always get the same answer. Silence.
That's the answer. So the secret to the new happiness is awareness, is becoming aware of all of these subconscious things that are running us, so that we can get a little more connected to that inner voice that will occasionally give us a truly original thought.
You're absolutely right. It's all a matter of mindfulness, mindfulness training. If we pay attention, if we become involved, if we're there in the moment, if we're mindful of what's going on in our heads, of the self-talk, then we begin to change the contents, if you will, in the unconscious. We'll just model that analogically to the old biocomputer, you know. There is a saying among computer programmers of old. It's called GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. Well, in a biological model, we have all kinds of garbage in our minds. And when we make these decisions, the ones that the MRI tech can predict in advance of our conscious awareness of what we're going to decide, it's because of the calculation of the information that's in our unconscious. If we don't get that out, if we don't choose to change it, to put in it what it is that we genuinely want, well, then we're nothing more than, in a sense, you know, some kind of a bit of a robot who is behaving the edict of, well, let me say it differently. Where on earth is your free will?
Right. But all that sounds a little intimidating and big and hard to tackle. So we're going to break it down. We can listen to, you know, audios and try to kind of reprogram, but that's not really doing the diagnostic work you're talking about. That's just sort of overriding not really digging up. You want to go into those catacombs and dig up these subconscious thoughts. That makes it easier to override them because the awareness is there. So one example of the digging is, like you were talking about, that dialoguing, which we do, that, you know, just also where, yes, where you pull up even an image and dialogue with the image from your subconscious. How else can we examine these beliefs so that we can bring them into awareness before we start doing the work to rewire them?
Well, you know, and again, I think the best way in the world to do that is to understand that you're going to live the rest of your life one breath at a time. And every time you have a breath, you're likely to have a thought. That's just how quickly the mind works. So you're going to look at your thoughts one thought at a time. And as you see a thought that is a self-defeating thought, a negative thought, take a proactive measure, you know. Jot it down if you don't have time to deal with it at the moment. Jot it down so you can look into it later. Cancel it if it's self-defeating. You know, you get one of these things, you're no good, you don't deserve that. Well, cancel, cancel, cancel that one. I'm going to choose to feel differently. Just say that to yourself. That's a proactive way of selecting what's in your mind. You can use, and I describe a number of different ways, you can use your dreams to make these kinds of changes. You can use affirmations. There are a number of ways, but the most important thing that I want to get communicated is it's not a monumental task if what I realize is I'm going to do it like I breathe. If I say to you, do you know how many breaths you're going to have in the rest of your life? And we were to estimate that, and we were to say you were going to live another 40, 50, 60 years, it would sound monumental. It would be in the hundreds of millions. But if I think about breathing as just something that happens natural as I go through my life, it's, you know, really not a lot of effort for almost all of us. Well, that's what I'm talking about doing. This is not a monumental task, but it is a task that you have to choose to put your foot on one step at a time. You know, Lao Tse said the greatest journey, the longest journey, it begins with a single step. And that's really what we're talking about. So I don't want anybody to think, oh my goodness, you know, I've got to take time out right now and I've got to go in there and I've got to dig out all these things. No, you're going to live your life and you're going to live into yourself as you live, because you're going to separate yourself, you know, the cream from the rest, by catching all this negativity that is in your mind that you didn't choose to put in your mind, that doesn't serve you today, that is there for all intent and purposes holding you back. And a lot of it is, you know, just exactly that. It's like that elephant who is tethered with a huge chain when it's a baby, and it smacks it three or four times, it falls to the ground, it buries its nose in the asphalt, and it gets to where when it's an adult, it feels that pressure on the leg, it doesn't test it anymore. You can almost tie it with a shoestring. It isn't going to test it anymore. And that's where a lot of people get with their lives, and that's a tragedy, because I know, I've seen, I'm absolutely convinced that within every human being there is just an absolutely, totally awesome potential to manifest a cornucopia of joy and happiness.
Hallelujah. So it's a mindfulness practice. It's an intentional mindfulness of your thoughts, just like your breath. You're going to breathe, you're going to think, so just be a little mindful of your thoughts, pull them out, question them, basically. Where do you stand, Eldon, on the whole going back and examining where the beliefs originated, going back into childhood traumas? Do you think that's a necessary component, or is it helpful in any way, or it really doesn't matter?
Well, I think all of the above. you know, there are some circumstances where it may be truly beneficial. We can have, adaptive mechanisms that the cause of which is so repressed that we just, you know, we can't get to it short of some therapeutic intervention. For most of us, that isn't applicable. For most of us, it's not necessary to go back and find out where that belief came from. And I think typically, you know, it's not even beneficial. If it's serious, that's a different issue. I want to make sure we understand that. But for what happens usually, and this is why I'm equivocating some, Lisa, what happens usually when people do that is they find someone to blame. Oh, I know where this comes from. My daddy did this to me. You know, and blame is always disempowering.
Sure.
You gain absolutely nothing out of blame. You know, there's two ways to be tied up in the world. Somebody can physically bind you. The other is you can hold on to a thread, like a, you know, just a thread attached to a doorknob and refuse to pull it hard enough to break it or to let go and walk away. Well, that's what a belief is like. It's that thread. So if your belief is so-and-so did this to me, what you're saying with that belief is there's nothing I can do about it. And that disempowers you. That robs you of your franchise. If you're going to be personally responsible for who you are, if you're going to take responsibility for your life, which is essential to manifesting your potential, you have to take responsibility for everything. I mean, listen, from the prison system work that I used to do as a criminalist, I can tell you that you could have two brothers come from the same home. One would be in a teaching hospital, teaching, a physician teaching young doctors, and the other one could be in maximum security for some crime. The one in the maximum security could tell us this atrocious story about everything they went through as a young person, you know, those my mommy was a prostitute, my daddy was an alcoholic kind of stories. Sometimes they were true, but most of the time they're just exaggerated. The fact of the matter is the two brothers had exactly the same circumstances. They made different choices. It's in our choice that we live our life. If you choose to blame someone, well, then you have disempowered yourself. There's nothing you can do about it, including forgive it. And I know from the hard research that the most important thing you can do to start yourself on a path to personal growth is get rid of the clutter in your life that we think of as blame. You have to forgive anyone and everything, including yourself, in order to begin to empower. In fact, as you know, Lisa, I believe this so much that, and we use this in the prison system in a very early study, lowering hostility and aggression, and that was cloned out to other prison systems, and I've used it with elite athletes, I've used it with Fortune 500 executives. You begin by understanding that I forgive myself, I forgive all others, I am forgiven, and when you do that, you suddenly can be proactive about anything and everything in your life. You then are in a place where you can change your feelings about what happened. You can change the direction, the propensity with which it started you to go can take and veer a complete different course. So instead of being bitter and angry, you can suddenly find a way to see what you learned from it.
Absolutely.
The bottom line,
radical forgiveness.
The bottom line to me is it's so critical that it used to be our best-selling InnerTalk program was forgiving and letting go. And when I realized that it is that important, we made it free, and that was about 15, 16 years ago, and it is still free to this day. You can get it at my website. It's a download. You can order it as a CD if you pay for the freight. But that's where you begin. I mean,
and that's eldentaylor.com or Progressive Awareness?
Eldentaylor.com will get you there. Just click on Free Programs on the left-hand navigation pane.
Great. So when you talk in this book, I believe, about the humans being herd animals, is this what you're talking about, how we just so much of what we believe and how we dress and all of that is programmed by the media and by our shared experience?
Well, yeah. Our shared experience is critical. The fact that it's important for us to be accepted. You know, I remember some very real, very early research, I should say, that was touch for health research. That's kind of dwindled away into the background now, but this research took infants. And in the studies, the infants would be handled, they were divided into groups, the infants would be handled during the course of the day, nice things said to them, they were stroked, and other infants were the handling was minimized. They could be, you know, the bottles might be propped up to them. And there was a tremendous difference in the growth of the two groups. The group that was receiving the attention not only grew faster, responded much stronger, gained quicker motor skills, but had fewer infections or secondary care issues as a result. When we look at ourselves, we are wired to do and behave in certain ways. And, you know, one of my favorites is this, you know, and everybody in the audience can do this one. Listening to this this telephone call, you can do this one. If you'll pick up your right foot for me, whether you're standing or you're sitting, pick up your right foot and begin to move it in a clockwise circle. Clockwise. Move it in a clockwise circle. Now, I'm assuming you're all moving it in a clockwise circle. Now use your right hand and draw a six in the air. Ah, but your foot turned and went counterclockwise, didn't it? See, we are subject to a machine. There is a mechanic about us, you know. We have two hemispheres. They process information differently. There are things about our physiology that is different. And you know, coming to understand that we are a machine is a part of becoming mindful. Okay, so if I stop for a minute and then I think, okay, the body is wired analogous to a government with the two budgets, one for defense and one for growth. Every time I put myself into a stressful situation, I have minimized the optimal operation of my ANS, my immune, and my endocrine system. In other words, I am building catecholamines that, for all intent and purposes, will help me age quickly, will help me suffer disease, will shut down my systems, etc. When I understand this, and I understand the mechanics of this whole process that we call our physiology, our body, I begin then to rethink the way that I go about my life. I begin to rethink the things that I take for automatic, I no longer take for automatic. I think almost everybody, just by way of an illustration, has been on the freeway. They've driven down the highway. Maybe, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, they've been completely occupied in some conversation with themselves. Suddenly there's their exit. They look up, oh, and they move over, change lanes to make that exit. And they've been driving perfectly safe, but they've been on total automatic. That automatic function is a part of how we operate. We have this shortcut system, this heuristics of thinking that gives rise to making choices and decisions for us that we can reframe and thereby change. And in reframing them, we change how we see the world. I think I've shared with you the spit analogy before, have I not, Lisa?
Yeah, no, tell them the spit analogy. I love that.
Okay. See, if we think about the saliva in our mouth for a moment, And we give it a rating, and I have to give mine a 10 because without it I can't have this conversation. We realize that we're really glad we have the saliva in our mouth. I mean, that it's a good thing, and we like it, and I like how mine tastes or doesn't taste. I'm just very happy it's there.
I like mine, yeah.
All right, now if you imagine that you have a little shot glass in front of you, and you deposit some of that saliva into that shot glass. You know, you just spit it in there. And now I ask you to drink it back. If you're 99% of the population, you're going to go, oh! And the reason you're going to do that is because spit in the glass is vile. But the saliva in my mouth is good. So we have these definitions, and all of a sudden, then we're watching UK's Got Talent, and out comes this disheveled housekeeper in circa 50s house dress, and Susan Boyle, and everybody in the audience is, you know, they're laughing, they're jeering, even the judges are rolling their eyes and shaking their heads, but when she opens her mouth, the most mellifluous sound comes out. What is it we need to question ourselves? What is it that makes me think a singer should look a certain way?
Right.
In this process of examining myself, in this process of being aware of the limitations of my machine, in this process of taking the context from every single thought I have, looking at the source of that thought, evaluating the belief, I begin to understand myself more. And so then it's not necessary for me to go digging into the archives deep down, to reach into that long bag, as Bly called it, and start pulling out what teacher told me that I shouldn't cry, what person, you know. And that's not as important as it is that I begin to become aware and make a choice to make it happen, to cause a change.
And what I really hear you saying, Eldon, is that, you know, most people associate happiness with manifestation, and I know that your message is really that it's not about the things, not about the outer circumstances, but about finding that happiness and that way to look at things differently. But also you're saying that you bring about your manifestations through these beliefs and by taking control of them and being mindful and paying attention to where you're placing your focus. I mean, you're the shining example of that. You've had all this amazing success. You've got beautiful wife and beautiful, beautiful marriage. And you're on George Norrie tonight, I understand, right? You're going to be on George Norrie. Tell everybody
That's
to
correct.
Listen to that. So yes, we manifest through these beliefs, but that's not the primary message about this bottom line on happiness, right? It's more.
I would say this to you for sure. There was a time in my life that, people would say I was a very jaded criminalist. I used my education to practice criminalistics, and I spent my days conducting lie detection tests, investigations, interrogations, perhaps a forensic hypnosis session. I never drove home the same way twice. I was always looking over my shoulder. You could call me paranoid, but then that's the way, you know, law enforcement gets. And I suspected everyone around me of being guilty of something or another. And where my outward appearance, my success as a business person was obvious, I had the big cars, the big homes, etc., my prestige as a criminalist was also obvious. My life was a miserable wreck. My personal life was, and I felt that way all the time. Today, the difference is what I'm trying to tell everyone. And my happiness comes from my ability to share this. And the stories and the people that come back to me that say, you wouldn't believe how my life has changed since this. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I call, and you know this, Lisa, we've chatted, what I call my warm fuzzies.
Yeah.
I'm not saying things that I have not lived and done. I have learned the hard way that happiness is a sense of feeling inside that comes and comes only when you have done your level best to go to the aid of another person. You know, when you have helped other people, when your life matters and you know that. We were talking about the hardwiring of the body. You are hardwired for the brain to bathe your body with positive neurochemicals when you do something as simple as write a check to a charity you care about. You are hardwired as that herd animal to benefit from a hug, to have your body bathed with these positive neurochemicals again, the endorphins, as a result of a 20-second hug. You are hardwired to receive these positive neurochemicals if you even just fake a smile. You are hardwired to benefit from assisting others. If you want to be happy, if you want to experience optimal wellness, well-being, take that step where I'm not looking any longer at what that pot's made of or what that the walls on that house or the roof on that house. I'm looking at the space. I'm looking at the energy. I'm looking at the experience and how I'm going to use it.
So beautifully articulated. Thank you so much, Eldon. Now, George Norrie, tell them in case they can listen tonight. What time?
Yes.
And how do they do that?
Coast to coast. I'll be with George for 3 hours from 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. Pacific
you're
time.
You're speaking Pacific time, right?
You
yes,
folks on
fine.
The East Coast could stay up all night. Gosh. But yes.
Hey, some
and
of
I'm
them
really looking
are
forward
anyway.
To it.
That's so fantastic. And we are all going to go support that campaign for I Believe because that is such a phenomenal book. Thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
Oh, it's been
go enjoy
totally
this happy
pleasure.
Launch day. Give Ravender my love. Give her a hug from me.
I'll do that. Lisa, hugs right back to you from both of us.
Aw, thank you.